This is Robert Shoemaker in Grass Valley, California, on August 5th, 1987.
Okay, do you...
Seems to be running.
You know, it's moving anyway. All right, this is Eleanor Swend, and I'm interviewing Bob Shoemaker in his beautiful Grass Valley home, and this is a supplement to the oral history of Frank McQuiston, who's now deceased, and suppose you tell us first in what connection you knew Frank and what your, how you came to work with him.
I first met Frank, or Mac as we call him, in New York, in when I was working for Union Carbide, and I was had been transferred from Niagara Falls down to New York and worked for the Union Carbide Ore Company. And
now, in what capacity were you working with Union Carbide?
Oh, I was just a metallurgical engineer. The Union Carbide Ore Company was a very small company in terms of people. We had 20, maybe 20 people in our head office, but it was run like a, you might say, a little kingdom. and we had mines throughout the world. Carbide was a major mining company at one time. And this was operated, they were all operated by nationals. There were no Americans overseas. And I got introduced to Frank by a fellow by the name of Bill Bloker, who worked for American Cyanamid at that time. And they both sponsored me into the mining club in New York. And so Frank and I would have lunch together every now and then.
What year was this?
Oh, from 50, probably 1958 until I left Carbide in March of 62. And being metallurgists, we seemed to kind of hit it off together. And so I left. I left Union Carbide in February, I guess it was, or the I went with Bechtel the 1st of March of 1962, and then I didn't hear anything from Mac until 1964, and I don't recall the dates, but Newmont came to Bechtel and said they wanted to build Carlin, and this was the first mining and metallurgical job that Bechtel had done for Newmont.
All right.
And
what metal were you working with for Union Carbide, or metals?
Manganese and chromium primarily, but well, we had mines, as I say, all over the world. We had one in Afghanistan. It was a that was a chromium mine. We had mines, chromium mines, in Rhodesia and South Africa, New Caledonia.
And were you doing any metallurgy for those?
Yeah. We also, we had manganese mines in Ghana, the largest manganese mine in the world, and one in British Guiana, and we bought manganese and chrome ores all from other mines. And we had two ferroalloy plants in Norway and one in England. And And then, of course, we furnished the manganese and chromium to all of the ferroalloy plants in the United States. I think there were five that were run by Union Carbide Metals Company. And so that time was in New York. I spent half my time in Norway for almost 5 years. And then I was in Australia and South Africa and Ghana and most every place they wanted to send me. So I wasn't home very much. But getting back to, or did you have any more questions?
No, I was just, that was just curiosity. So
getting back to Carlin.
To Bechtel.
Yeah. And
to California then?
Yeah, we moved to Millbrae.
Mm-hmm.
And Bechtel was just getting into the mining and metals business in a fairly large way at that time. They had built their first metallurgical plant in Riddle, Oregon for Hanna Nickel, M.A. Hanna Company. And that was in 1954. And then they'd built a couple of iron ore plants and a couple of aluminum plants, about one plant at a time, and then they decided that they wanted to expand their mining and metallurgical business, so they, I was the second metallurgist that they'd hired. Before that, they had been, you might say, almost a drafting service and a construction service to these Hanna Company and Reynolds Metals. And so they decided to hire metallurgists. Eventually we had 35. I had 35 working for me.
You were their manager.
Well, after a couple of years, I became chief metallurgical engineer with the first one that they'd had. And eventually I had 35 metallurgists working for me.
And who was the first one they hired? You said?
Alan Taylor, you probably know Ruth Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
He and I had worked together in a mine up in Oregon back in 1947. That's where I first met him, and then lost track of him. He stayed out of school. I went back to school, and he stayed out. But he, for about 10 years, and eventually he went back to Minnesota and became a metallurgist, and that was his first job out there. That is, with Bechtel after he got out of school. So.
Recruit you?
No, he didn't know anything about that they were even attempting to recruit me. And here I arrived and found that he was working. I didn't know it.
How did you happen to get the job with Bechtel?
Oh, that was through mutual. I had a friend that was the president of Alan Sherman Hoff Pump Company, and he was a good friend of a fellow in Bechtel. And this fellow had been given a job of recruiting metallurgists. He was semi-retired. And I'd never even heard of Bechtel at the time. And this man called me up one day, and he told me that this friend of mine had told him I might possibly be available for the right price. And so we he came and interviewed me, or I interviewed him, one of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get back to the West, because we'd been back east for 12 years at that time. And I could see that the Union Carbide Ore Company was going to be absorbed by one of the other divisions of the corporation, and it wouldn't be like it was. One of the founders of Union Carbide was also, this is back in 1898, was also, he founded the Union Carbide Ore Company, and it was his, and he still owned 3% of the carbide stock, and he could pretty well do what he pleased. And no one, and he was in his 90s.
What was his name?
I'll think of it in a minute. His grandson later became chairman of the board. He came into the office couple times a week. And
98 years old?
90, he was 90 at the time, and he died when he was 93, I think it was. But we had an office separate from Union Carbide offices down on 42nd Street, and we were up on Madison Avenue, and we had one floor of a four- or five-story building. And it was, as they say, it was run just like he had run it when he founded the company. And we had Persian or Turkish rugs on the floor. And I had the most beautiful mahogany desk you've ever seen in your life. It was, and they would send a man in once a month to rub it down with rotten stone and oil. And a lady would come in and polish and disinfect the telephones once a week. And the guy came in every morning and shined our shoes. It was just like they had done it in the old days.
But you didn't think it was going to last.
It lasted for about 3 years, and then they built a new carbide building, and they moved us all into that, and then everything was regimented. They even took away all of our furniture and gave it to the government as a tax write-off. So then they bought new furniture and got it delivered free, so they didn't have to move the old stuff. But they were just great people. It was nothing like working for the big part of Union Carbide. They would send Gene to Norway with me and pay the babysitter every year. And on one of my trips, I made four trips there a year. So she would go to Norway with me once a year.
Oh, nice.
And for a month, too. And then, so it was, even though I was gone a lot of the time, it was very nice.
Yeah. Where did you live?
On Long Island.
But you still wanted to go back west.
And it was a good thing, because the old man died about 6 months afterwards, after I left, and they were immediately absorbed by the Union Carbide Metals Company, and then it was just entirely changed. And
sure.
So I'm glad that I left at that time.
So Bechtel came hunting for you? And
so I went out to San Francisco, and I didn't know anything about Bechtel, but I thought I'd try engineering for a year, and if I didn't like it, then at least I'd had a free ride out to the West, and I'd give it a try for a year, and if I didn't like it, then I would go looking for a job with a mining company.
stayed for 20 years at Beckley.
19 years, yeah. And engineering business kind of gets in your blood, and and Bechtel was a fine company to work for, very fine. But anyway, they, Newmont, Frank McQuiston and Dave Christie at that time, and a couple of their engineers came to San Francisco, and they'd made arrangements to come see us, and they wanted to build a gold plant, which was the first gold plant that, of any size at all that had been put in the United States in 30 years. And they had found this ore body at Carlin. Actually, the USGS had been doing some exploration work there under their heavy metals program at that time. And
now let's see, this was
in 64.
Korea was?
That was in the 50s.
Was that when they started?
Yeah, the heavy metals program was, they were looking for tungsten and gold or any type of metal, really, as a result of the Korean War. And so the USGS found indications of gold, and
now this is a new kind of gold.
Well, it's only one kind, but it was it was the first of the microscopic gold deposits, and low grade, relatively low grade. And
now, was this possible? This discovery was possible because of new technology, was it?
No. They just merely they did some geochemical work and did some surface sampling, and and assayed and found gold there. There had been a little bit of alluvial gold mining in the creek just below Carlin, but it was virtually nothing. And during the 50s, there was a gold mine a few miles away called the Bootstrap Mine. And this was owned and operated by three men. One of them, his name was Harry Treweek, T-R-E-W-E-E-K.
Good old Cornish name.
Yes. And he had been the manager of a plant called Little Gold Acres, which is over in Crescent Valley, south of Beowawe and east of Carlin, the town of Carlin. And they had put, he was the manager of Little Gold Acres, and it was a small plant, but it was very successful. It was put in the 1930s, probably the late 1930s, and it ran all during the war, because it was a Canadian owned company, and it got around, or at least it was partly Canadian owned, and it, so they were able to get around this L208 order.
Right. That's interesting.
And then it became exhausted, and then another company started a mine called Consolidated Gold Acres right next door on a different piece of ground. And it ran up into in the mid-50s. But they were both small plants.
Now they had mills as well as mines?
The Little Gold Acres plant was merely crushing and vat leaching. And the Consolidated Gold Acres was crushing and grinding and cyanidation, typical cyanidation flow sheet. And that is really a Carlin, those were Carlin type ores. They were, you couldn't see the gold in them. And later they have been mined again by Cortez Gold Mines, which is owned by Placer Amex. Because it's just, they are just 9 miles across the valley from Cortez Gold Mine.
That's spelled with a Z or anything?
Z. And that's kind of an interesting, Consolidated Gold Acres is an interesting, because the plant was built by a Western Machinery Company out of Sacramento, which was owned by Jack Howe, if you've ever heard of him. He's quite a famous character in the mining industry. And Howe later started Western Knapp Engineering, which was bought out, and finally now it's Davy. It was bought out by McKee, and then Davy bought out McKee. But he had built this gold plant in Northern California, and I don't recall just where, and people there couldn't pay for it. So he tore down the mill, or removed the mill from Northern California, and made a deal with Consolidated Gold Acres and moved it, the mill, to Consolidated Gold Acres. And he took I believe he had a figure for the mill. I've forgotten what it was. It's in a little historical magazine I have over there. But he took made a deal that he would get twice the value of the mill for putting it in on credit. And he also would operate it and have control of it. And then the mill made money, and he made an enormous amount of money, and then he turned it back to the Consolidated Gold Acres. Mm-hmm. And Harry Trewick was the manager. Well, then when that mine worked out, Harry went over to the Bootstrap, and the three people, he and his two partners, operated the Bootstrap as a vat leach operation again, just merely crushing and vat leaching, and they made an awful lot of money for those days. And one of their people started a fire accidentally that burned a lot of acreage on the T. Lazy S. Ranch, which was Tex Thornton and Roy Ash. And Thornton and Ash um, sued the bootstrap operation, and they didn't have the money to pay off the judgment that was brought against them for burning up the rangeland out there. And so Newmont came to their rescue and made a settlement and took over the property. And I think that is where Newmont got interested, because that was in the middle 50s.
They must have had somebody out there who was aware of what was going on.
Yeah.
And this.
Bob Fulton was out there. They were exploring about that time, or starting to explore. And anyway, Harry came out of it as a millionaire with the money that he made. That's not my phone, that's Gene's phone. But anyway, Harry became a millionaire, but you'd never tell it. He's just a little, nice little Cornishman, and the finest assayer in the world. Newmont was exploring then the Carlin deposit, and they hired Harry to do their assaying for him. And they wanted to keep it secret that they had a gold deposit there. And so Harry was using the assay office at Consolidated Gold Acres, which had been abandoned for some time. But he made arrangements to use, somehow had made arrangements to use that assay office. And he and his wife worked there at night. And this is, it was 60 miles from the town of Carlin.
And
the geologist would bring the samples down at night to Consolidated Gold Acres, and Harry and his wife Clemmie did the assaying there at night to keep it a secret. And then so the Carlin ore body was found, and then one day in 1964, McQuiston and two or three of these other Newmont people showed up at Bechtel's doorstep and said, "We've got to have a gold plant built, and we got to have it built right now."
The secret was out by then, I guess.
Yeah. And
do you have any idea how Bechtel happened to be selected for this?
No. There was no... they had obviously heard about our work in iron ore, and there was no business development effort or anything. They just called up, said they were coming out to see us, and when they walked in the office, they said, "We got to have a gold plant. We got to have it in a hurry."
Now this is Bechtel's first venture into gold.
Yes, and
Newmont had been in gold before.
Well. Had been here in gold at the Empire Star. Then they had one in Colorado up near Ouray. And then they had a small one up in Canada, and they call that one the Northern Empire Mine. But they had been in an investment house primarily. Of course, they were in the copper business, too. This one, the Empire Star here, was their first venture in outside of being an investment house. They were a mining investment house under Colonel Boyce Thompson. And Fred Searles saw the opportunity out here and bought or took options on the both the Empire and the North Star, and convinced Mr. Thompson to buy the mines for Newmont, so they operated. And this was in
1929. Right, but they really hadn't been
told
for a long time.
This, the Empire Star finally shut down in 1956, but in the, or maybe it was 55, I think it was early 56. In the last few years, they had run the mill, but it just leased out portions of the mine.
And Frank's connection here was a long one.
Yes, he left. He ended up as chief metallurgist, and then chief metallurgist for the Western United States for Newmont.
Were you aware, when he came back now with Bechtel, to Bechtel, were you aware that he had done the first flotation work? In
no.
We must mention this.
That was, that I heard, found out later that he had installed the first flotation circuit in the mother lode.
You had known him as a copper manager.
Copper and gold, yeah, from Newmont, or from Carlin. Well, they were in such a hurry that we had...
Excuse me just a second. Okay.
We had equipment out there 3 days after they walked in the office, leveling off the top of this hill, and we finished the plant, well, in I think it was 10 and a half months. We did the engineering and construction simultaneously, and
now, did Bechtel do the construction also?
Yeah.
10 months from start?
10 and a half months, yeah. And that was through winter time, too. Mm-hmm. And all the conditions were out there was horrible. It was, I think, 17 miles from the town of Carlin, which was on what is now Highway 80, and it was a gravel and dirt road. And
spending a lot of time out there on the site?
I made a number of trips out there. I had my metallurgist working on the thing, I worked on it, and I remember making one trip out there where I had, it was in the winter time, and I was going up to Oregon, and I left the family at Winnemucca and then drove over to Carlin and then started north up to the Carlin Mill, a 17 miles, and I had chains on all 17 miles because of the mud. It was quite a trip. And but anyway, the mill worked very fine.
Now, what's the relationship when you have a company like Newmont that wants to build a mill, and they have a metallurgist who's well known and competent, and they hire Bechtel, and they have a metallurgist who's well known and competent? What's the relationship there?
They don't hire only. I had no gold experience, so they didn't hire me and hire Bechtel because of me. But for our electrical and mechanical and civil engineering design people, and also our construction ability, good construction people that knew how to get a job done.
Well, who makes the decision?
So they had their flow sheet already worked out when they walked in the door. So
you're doing it to their specification.
Yeah. And we had layout people that were able to help out. They didn't have, we had to fit the plant to the site, and actually a gold plant like that is fairly simple. It's a series of unit operations that you have to put together and it doesn't make any difference whether these unit operations are all in one line or in a square or inside of any particular type of building. They have to be connected together in the most efficient manner.
Was there anything new and different about this metallurgy because of the nature of the...
No, it was very simple metallurgy. It was much simpler than say Homestakes at Lead, because the ore was so the gold was microscopic. It was evenly distributed throughout the ore, and the only problem they had was with the chert, which was in the ore, which was hard to grind. But most of the ore was a siltstone with clay. And the other problem they had, they thought that the ore would be fairly dry, and that's something that all the people who have put in mines in Nevada have come to realize that is not true.
It is a surprise. Everything there is dry.
They had put down a decline shaft. I'm not sure if it was a decline or just a tunnel. And they had mined out enough ore to do test work on a fairly large scale back in their Danbury laboratories. And they thought the ore was going to be dry, and it turned out it was the stickiest stuff in the world. It was just terrible. So the crushing plant wasn't really suited for crushing that type of ore. They had to fight that crushing plant all the time. And they made a number of minor...
This is not an underground mine.
No. They only drove that tunnel just to get a sample.
I wanted to be sure I hadn't made a mistake.
And And then the ore hung up in the fine ore bins because it was so wet and sticky. And they used only a single ball mill, and the chert that was in the ore, there was more of that than they had thought. And the chert chips would come out of the ball mill, and they just have mountains of them piled up outside of the mill because they just couldn't grind the chert. And but eventually they overcame these problems. And
now you say they, then
Carlin people did, yeah. Mac and the mill superintendent and the mine superintendent. Otherwise, the mill ran very well. It was, these were, oh, I guess, relatively minor problems. We know how today to design around this wet, sticky ore. We could have, at that time, autogenous and semi-autogenous grinding had been used on the iron ore, in the iron ore country, up in Minnesota and Michigan and up in Canada, and we'd installed a number of them, of these semi-autogenous mills. But at that time, everyone thought that only iron ore would grind autogenously, and there wasn't time to test it on the Carlin ore.
Now, what was the rush?
They found that, well, they just wanted a gold mine. They figured it would be very profitable, which it was, and so they wanted it in a hurry. And they got it in a hurry. And
at a premium, no doubt?
Actually, it didn't cost very much. It was a fair amount for those days. It was...
probably pay more to get a rush job, though, don't you?
Well, that's true. It was a union job, and we had to pull, I remember, electricians out of Reno, and the good electricians didn't want to go out to Carlin, and so we got the poor ones, the wire benders, in effect. And at one time we had 120 electricians on the job. I think half of them were doing the work over that the other half had done in the first place. So it did cost more money, but the whole plant cost about $8 million, which for 1962 or 1964 was not an enormous amount of money.
You hired most of your people relatively locally? Well, Reno's a long ways from Carlin.
Yeah, those were... Well, Carlin was a pretty small town at that time.
How far east of Reno is it?
It's 200 miles. But Elko was a very... That was the nearest large town, and 35 miles away, and that had a population of only about 4,000 or 5,000 at that
so
time.
You had to bring most of your workers in.
Yes.
Did you provide housing for them?
A lot of them lived in trailers and...
Did you provide the housing site to it? Was this part of your designing?
I don't know. We didn't... we didn't have a camp there. But people brought in trailers and lived in Carlin and Elko.
Did Newmont provide a camp for their workers?
No. There were a few houses available in Elko, and they built the manager's house, but they didn't buy and build anybody else's house. Today, the mining companies do build at least for their staff or give them loans.
What were your relations through this with Frank? Were you collaborating with him at all?
Yes. I had two metallurgists on the job that were really more mechanical engineers doing the piping and all the necessary pump and piping calculations and I worked with the project engineer's name was Rod Hunt, and he was kind of an old timer at engineering and construction and had been with Utah Construction before.
He was a Bechtel?
Yeah. And anyway, the plant worked very well considering the sticky ore, and it was up to full production, I think, in a matter of about 2 weeks after it started. And
it was a sensation at the time, of course, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, and it made them an enormous amount of money, even at $35 gold.
Which it still was.
And then it went to 37 shortly after that, and then eventually started on up. But it made a lot of money for them. And then they later expanded it by, it was 2,000 tons a day, and they expanded it by another 500 tons a day to treat carbonaceous ores by chlorination.
Did this first circuit was?
Just straight grinding, cyanidation in agitated tanks, and countercurrent decantation with five thickeners and zinc precipitation. It was very standard flow sheet. This was a matter of just putting in a few tanks and agitators and adding chlorine and began treating carbonaceous ore.
They were getting into a different kind of ore then.
Yeah.
Were there environmentalists?
No, thank goodness.
Didn't have to consider those things at that time?
Not at all. The only thing they had to consider was the T. Lazy S. Ranch, which was a cattle ranch and of extremely large size. And I...
Well, now, Newmont had settled with them about the fire.
They... Well, Newmont bought the bootstrap operation from Treweek and his partners and bailed them out of their obligation to the T-Lazy S. And later, Newmont put in a heap leach at on the low-grade ore that was still left at the bootstrap. Well, in fact, they trucked a lot of the ore from the bootstrap to the Carlin Mill, and that was about 10 miles, 9 or 10 miles. When Treweek was running the bootstrap, they could only take the highest grade ore because it was a small operation. Harry, as I say, he lived very modestly, but he's left $1 million to the Colorado School of Mines.
Was this his alma mater?
Yes, he was, and he was a great friend of Max. Just, they were the finest of friends.
From a long time back?
No, when from his, when they first met there at the Carlin operation.
This is when they first met.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Harry later retired, and and then was a consultant on assaying both to Carlin and to other plants around. But you asked me about environmental problems, and I said the only problem they had was the T-Lazy S. And part of their, and I can't tell you what percentage, but part of their mine was, the Carlin mine was on T-Lazy S ground, and they had to pay a royalty. They also, T-Lazy S refused to lease or sell land to Newmont for a tailings pond. And the Carlin mine is up on the top of this hill, and there's beautiful tailing sites down below, but T-Lazy S wouldn't sell it to them, so they had to put in a very expensive tailings dam, which was included in the $8 million, as well as, like I say, piped water for 14 miles, and they had to bring in a power line that was 40 miles long, and that was all in that $8 million. But this tailings dam will eventually be 300 feet high, and one of the highest tailings dams in the United States.
And this is necessary because they couldn't get the...
They couldn't get permission from the T-Lazy S to use a few acres of this couple of 100,000 acres that T-Lazy S had. And they had a lot more trouble with T-Lazy S because they would want to do some exploration, and sometimes on T-Lazy S ground, sometimes on BLM ground, but they'd have to go through T-Lazy S property. And so T-Lazy S, every time that they wanted anything, T-Lazy S would have to have new water tanks or new gates or new fences. And the way they described it to me was just constant harassment by T-Lazy S. And I guess they killed two or three T-Lazy S cows that broke through the fence and drank water out of the tailings pond. And of course, those were horribly expensive cows. And Mac told me that he tried to convince Newmont to purchase the T-Lazy S Ranch. And one time, at that time, they could have purchased it for $5 million, which would have been an enormous bargain, but Plato didn't want to be in the ranching business. It's interesting now because since they have bought the T-Lazy S for many, many millions of dollars, and I can't tell you how much, but an enormous amount of money. All of the Newmont people that I know are wearing T-Lazy S tie clasps.
They love it now.
Yeah. So
Newmont eventually did have to buy the ranch.
They eventually did. And it had what is now called the Gold Quarry deposit on it, and of which they have, I believe, bought 10%. Yeah, they own the ranch, but they only own 10%, I think, of Gold Quarry. And so Roy Ash gets his royalty on 90% of the Gold Quarry ore.
So McQuiston was rather far-sighted in that, wasn't he?
Yes, but he was frustrated because they wouldn't let him, they wouldn't buy. Mac would occasionally get pretty frustrated with Plato. As I mentioned to you last night, Plato has only visited the Carlin plant twice that Mac told me about. The second time, the first time was at the dedication of the Carlin mine, and Plato was supposed to be there for 2 days. They put him up at the Stockman's Hotel in the suite, but it was right alongside of the railroad tracks, and he didn't get any sleep, so he asked Steve Bechtel to fly him to San Francisco in Steve's airplane the next morning, and didn't attend the second part of the dedication. And then he came out one more time in the last few years before he retired, even though it made such an enormous amount of money for Newmont.
You mentioned that it really carried the company through the...
It certainly did. When the copper business started to go downhill, Newmont maintained its dividends with Carlin Gold money. They had a lot of ore stockpiled ahead of the plant, and some of it quite high grade. I have been at the Carlin plant many, many times in the, over the years, and I can recall them mining small pockets of ore with a one-ton truck and a very small front-end loader. And they would take this ore, it would run as much as half an ounce of ore. No, excuse me, it would run 1 to even 3 ounces. And they would stockpile that ore in us. Yeah. And they would stockpile that, and then when Plato would want some more gold, he'd just call up and tell them to turn the faucet on, and they'd put that through the mill.
Now, are these decisions generally made at that level? The grade of ore running through the mill?
Yes, they have. They would set up a budget and goals for each year, and but it was constantly being reviewed by the New York office, and if they would all of a sudden want more money, well, they would just tell them to put the high grade through the mill. It was quite a remarkable operation in that case. They never sold gold forward. They may possibly do it today, but they, for many, many years, they never sold gold forward. Even when the price was going up, had gone up, they sold it strictly on a spot basis.
Does this complicate your mill design to have that sort of thing?
No, not at all. One of the interesting things that happened that Mac was involved in was a theft out there at Carlin. And it was strange how it was discovered. This was in the days when gold, you still had to have a gold license to have and possess gold, and when gold was still $35, $37 an ounce.
I think 1971 was when that.
Yeah, I believe thereabouts. And Mac told me that the Treasury Department, who had charge of issuing these licenses, had been suspicious of a gold refiner in Chicago who they seemed to think had more gold than he should. And he refined gold and sold it to jewelers and so on, jewelry manufacturers. And so they started following this man or one of his people and found that he was flying to Reno. And so they followed him to Reno and saw that he had meetings with a couple of people in Reno who were known to be gold buyers.
they would buy gold from dentists and jewelry companies and so on, scrap gold. And then they started following these two people and found that they were having meetings with people from Carlin. And it was obvious that this gold was coming from Carlin. And so then they brought in the Secret Service, and who I guess was the enforcement agency. And they went to Newmont and said, you're losing gold. And Newmont says, no, we're not losing any gold. What gave you that idea? And so they told them, and then they started an investigation and found the chief chemist and his assistant were in cahoots with the three men in the refinery. And the chief chemist was the one that would, he was in charge of the assaying, so he was cooking his assay books. The head, the assay of the ore that went into the mill, what we call the heads, and he was then cooking the tails also, the assays of the tails. So anyway, the amount of gold produced would match the what they would predict from the assays. And these people in the furnace room were stealing precipitate, gold, zinc precipitate. So it didn't show up on the books. And they stole the stuff and sold it. And this had gone on for I guess about a year. And only one of them, I believe, the chief chemist, went to jail, and he was only in jail for about 4 months. Of course, Newmont had insurance, or Carlin had insurance, but the problem was to prove how much gold had been stolen. Because these people that stole it, they weren't admitting anything, and so Mac went over there and